Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I'm going to take you way back. This is the year 2006. I am a freshman or a sophomore at UC Riverside in California. I've just been introduced to Stoic philosophy. I hear about Marcus Aurelius. I hear about Epictetus. I get the Gregory Hayes translation. Dr. Drew is the one who first turns me on to the Stoics. I read Marcus Aurelius. I love it. I go, okay, what translation of Epictetus should I read, even though I'm probably then pronouncing it Epictetus or something? And I go to Borders in the Riverside Plaza, which is currently a Forever 21, but then it was, it might not even be a Forever 21 anymore, but at the time, it was a Borders bookstore, my favorite bookstore. I loved it more than Barnes & Noble at the time. And I walk into the philosophy section, I look for Epictetus, and I see one called The Art of Living. That seemed way more accessible and more my style than the Enchiridion or the Discourses. So I get it. It's The Art of Living, the classical manual on virtue, happiness, and effectiveness, a new interpretation by Sharon LaBelle. I buy it and read it. It was very accessible, almost too accessible, I felt at the time, and I did go read the others. I wondered, like, is this really, could the Stoics have really been this straightforward and clear? I don't know. It was too easy. I was like convinced maybe it wasn't right or I don't know. But this really is how the Stoics wrote. And I am holding that copy in front of you and I can see some of the passages that I've marked. Here's page 58. Don't be afraid of verbal abuse or criticism. Only the morally weak feel compelled to defend or explain themselves to others. Let the quality of your deeds speak on your behalf. Page 7. Open your eyes. See things for what they really are, thereby sparing yourself the pain of false attachments and avoidable devastation. Or page 77. If someone tries to impress you, claiming to understand the writings and ideas of a great thinker such as Chrysippus, think to yourself, the important thing is not merely to be able to speak fluently about obtuse subjects. What is essential is to understand nature and align your attentions with the actions and actions with the way things are. Anyways, you can see why I love the translation. As it happened many years later, I would get my first book agent, Steve Hanselman, who would turn out to have played a role in publishing it, which I talk about with today's guest, the one and only Sharon LaBelle, who 20
years after she published it, maybe more, came on the Daily Stoic podcast. We had a wonderful conversation. We talk about stoicism. We talk about translations. We talk about the role of men and women in Stoic philosophy. We talk about virtue specifically. Towards the end, we get into her take on the four virtues, which reminds me, my new book, the first in my series on the four virtues, is coming out September 28th. You can pre-order it, dailystoic.com/pre-order. We got a bunch of awesome bonuses. Not only can you get signed copies from me if you order at dailystoic.com/pre-order, but if you want a signed page from the manuscript that I wrote, like an actual part of the process accumulation of the book, there's also a way you can get those. So you can go to dailystoic.com/pre-order for my new book on the four virtues, the first of which being Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. Check that out if you want to support the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And if you haven't yet read Epictetus and you're looking for a place to start, Sharon LaBelle's wonderful, accessible translation, The Art of Living, the classical manual on virtue, happiness, and effectiveness, is a good place to start. We sell it in the Painted Porch, so I'll have a link in the description below, or get it anywhere you get books. Here's my interview with Sharon LaBelle. I was trying to think when we last saw each other. It would have been in Toronto for StoicCon. I have no conception of time anymore. That could have been 10 years ago or 2.5 years ago.
Well, we're on the same team time-wise. But I do think that's right. It was in Toronto at a StoicCon. And you made a big impression on me.
Your work made a very big impression on me. This would have been in 2006 or 2007. That's what I would have gotten it. Borders books still existed. And I remember getting it there. And the other funny thing is that Steve Hanselman, who I would work on with on the Daily Stoic and also would become my agent, he was the publisher, right?
Of
The Art of Living.
Well, he worked for the same publisher, but in those days, because we're really talking early Paleolithic.
Yes.
This was, in fact, I'm quite sure that the book came out even before he began working for the company.
Yeah. Well, it was meant to be. It was all aligned, and here we are.
Here we are. And I'm just thrilled by the work that you are doing in the world. I just think you're giving modern Stoicism such a straightforward, simple voice, and it means a lot to a lot of people. I'm sure you know that, but
well, that's
I'm
very
one
kind.
Of those people.
Well, that's very kind, and you were the I would say you were the ultimate pioneer of this trend. So, I want to get to that, but it did occur to me, we were just talking about time passing, this sort of weird limbo period where we've all not been able to do what we've wanted to do, and we couldn't see people the way. It does kind of give you a glimpse into what, I don't know, Epictetus's or Seneca's exile must have been like. You know, it's not like they were thrown in jail exactly, but they were socially distanced from Rome, you could say.
That's beautiful. I've never looked at the last year and a half through such a beneficent lens.
Well, one of the things that hit me about Seneca's isle specifically, and I think I did a Daily Stoic email about this, is so he's exiled to Corsica, which I don't know that much about. But early in the pandemic, I was reading this biography of Napoleon, and Napoleon is from Corsica. And he writes, you know, Napoleon, like it's like when Napoleon is sent off to exile, he passes the island and he, you know, they stop and they let him have sort of one last longing look at it. It was like, I guess what, you know, Epictetus talks about how every situation has two handles. It struck me as this vivid example of it because Seneca sees it as this horrible punishment and he hates it. Meanwhile, yes. Napoleon, coming from the same place, obviously many generations apart, although I can't imagine it changed that much, you know, sees it as
this source of fond, beautiful, wonderful memories, which I guess just goes to show, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
Indeed. And in some ways, well, my mind always jumps to symbolism. It seems like Napoleon represented, or excuse me, I think I've got them flipped. Seneca represented human nature that's uncultured, and Napoleon represents wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's that, you know, if you decide to see it as a horrible punishment, you will hate it. And if you decide to see it as a wonderful, beautiful island that you have all your fondest memories on, it will also be that.
Yes. Yes.
So walk me through your introduction to our friend Epictetus. How does this happen, and how does he come into your life?
Well, definitely through happenstance, because as I know that you know so well, no one cared about Stoicism, much less Epictetus back in, this would have been the early 90s when I first came to read him. And the reason I came to read him is he was just part of a kind of an inevitable chain of books that I read ever since I was young enough to read, because I've always been philosophically minded. And in some ways, I would say my two obsessions are meaningfulness. How does one have a meaningful life? How does one have a meaningful moment, a meaningful day? And then the idea of ordinary virtue. Virtue as it's expressed on the ground in, you know, within the what some people would call the mundane, though hearkening back to Seneca and Napoleon, you know, you can see our ordinary moments as mundane or as majestic or as, you know, keys to the kingdom, whatever your kingdom is. Anyway, be that, but I digress. So I always read philosophy. And when I was a young married woman and having babies and such, I was really on a existentialism jag. And then I have to say, I don't even really remember who, or, you know, there's no like pivotal watershed moment when Epictetus was put in my hands, but I read his discourses. And in those days, sort of the spiritual or pop psych, call it what you will, ethos, was everybody was into Eastern religions. Sure. You know, if you were a hip daddy-o kind of person. And so when I first read Epictetus, I almost felt like I was, you know, betraying the zeitgeist or something, because, you know, in those days, it was not considered cool to be a dead white man, Western philosopher. You know, that whole category of Western moral philosophy was looked at as being, well, just kind of like you're manacling yourself to a wall. It seemed rigid. This was not my judgment, but it was confusing for me at first when I first read his stuff, because I wasn't supposed to like it. You know, I was so busy practicing Tibetan Buddhism and, all of that. Definitely a person of my generation. I did what people did. But I was just thunderstruck by how relevant Epictetus's words seemed, not just to my life, but to the lives of everyone I loved and cared about. And so I started messing around writing his ideas in a more accessible way, because I suppose it's kind of my personal marching orders for myself are to rescue philosophy from the philosophers.
Mine too. And,
yes, I noticed that. And along with that, to rescue the notion of virtue from the sanctimonious. And then furthermore, to rescue art from the critics. Artistic expression looms large in my life. And somehow this triad, kind of each part of it nourishes the other.
Do I remember you telling me that a neighbor had introduced you to philosophy as a young girl as well?
Yes. And in fact, oh gosh, you've got a memory like an elephant. Yes. I suppose that would be the genesis of everything. I grew up in a very multicultural neighborhood, and the fellow who lived across the street, his name was Narayan Champawat, and he was a philosophy professor from India, and he owned more books than anyone I ever knew. In fact, we had a really bad earthquake one time, and we had to manhandle him out of his house because he wouldn't leave his books. And I can kind of relate to it, but I choose life. Anyway, so yeah, Narayan Champawat, you know, I think he recognized that I used to come over to his house to play with his kids, and I think he saw that I was kind of a misfit or a square peg trying to make it in a round hole. And he gave me a book that was, I'm pretty sure it was like a college freshman's intro to philosophy or something. But I took it home and I read it cover to cover, like it was, you know, Talmud or something. And that was the pivot point. That's when I thought, Western philosophy, I need to dive into this, however incrementally.
What I love about that is the idea that this has kind of been this unbroken chain of that happening, right? So how is Marcus Aurelius introduced to Epictetus? You know, Rusticus just gives him a copy of these notes from his own library. I think I even read George Washington is introduced to the Stoics by a neighbor, just like you were. I just love the idea of like, hey, this worked for me. Maybe you should check it out. Being a really old, timeless sort of passing of torches.
Yes. Oh, that's such a beautiful image. And it's really true. I also need to, for a second, jump on just an incidental phrase you just used in talking about Washington and his neighbor that, you know, hey, this works.
Yeah.
You might want to check. Because if I had to say what Stoicism is, you know, just on one foot, like Hillel or something,
yes,
I would just say that Stoicism teaches us how to do what works and quit doing what doesn't.
Yeah.
All said and done, you know, because we're kind of always bashing ourselves against the brick wall of how we want things to be rather than how they are.
Well, if I was to do Epictetus in standing on one leg, for people who don't know the Hillel reference you made, which I only recently encountered, Hillel was asked to basically explain the Jewish faith while standing on one foot, and he said, "Love thy neighbor as thyself; all the rest is commentary."
Yes.
Which I think is so beautiful and sadly very much missed here, you know, in the middle of this pandemic. But I feel like Epictetus, and then I have your translation here of it, I think Epictetus standing on one foot says, some things are within our control and some things are not. That, yes. To me, that is the essence of Stoicism as well, right there.
Exactly. And so, given what you just said, then I would just put on the tagline, so act accordingly.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Right. So focus, so put all 100% of your energy towards the things that are up to you.
Yes, which is a vast number of things. I think that's the thing that we so forget, right? Because we're yes. so focused. Oh, dang it, I don't control this. Dang it, I don't control that. But look at the other side of the ledger. It's a long ledger on the other side. There's so much we can do.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
I think that's totally right. And even if it wasn't, I think the other way to think about it is, like, let's say you don't control everything that happens. The Stoics say you control how you respond. So right. it sort of becomes this, like, I'm rubber, you're glue. It just, you know, like it's the ultimate retort, right? Like yeah, yes, you don't yeah. control what happens, but you control what you do about what happens. And so you essentially control everything that matters.
Right. Well said.
So why do you think Epictetus is this underrated figure? I want to talk about your translation, but what you're saying is true, I think. And it's weird, especially now, right? Like, I remember there was some sort of sneering article about my work and its popularity in Silicon Valley a couple years ago that was like, these Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are using a philosophy popular with Greek slaves. And it struck me that...
Oh, please. Sorry.
It struck me that given our focus on privilege and you know, sort of, I don't want to say, I'm using this ironically, canceling, you know, sort of racist or colonial figures from the past, it seems like Epictetus should move to the front of the line of our philosophical heroes, because he was one of a handful of them who were not privileged, who were not slave owners, who experienced real adversities, who were not just, you know, rich white guys. You know, it seems like he would be who we would be celebrating as we're trying to diversify the Western canon. But for some reason, even with the popularity of your work, that hasn't quite happened. He's still mostly unknown.
Yes. It's, you know, I would like to say that I had the answer to that question, but, and I could you know, make up some pat response that would be plausible. But to be really honest, I don't know. Maybe it's because people have trouble pronouncing his name.
Yep. Epictetus, no, how do you say it? Yeah.
Right, right. It's puzzling to me why anyone would have a problem with it, especially because of how you so ably described him. Is he wasn't, you know, I could understand people getting a little bent out of shape about Seneca, you know, a man of privilege. And
yeah, Mary Beard recently referred to Marcus Aurelius as a fascist, you know, that he was the emperor. And you're like, okay, I get what you're saying. I mean, it's technically true, but like, you can't say any of that stuff about Epictetus.
No, you can't. He wins everyone. He's a slave. He's got a limp. He's everything. And he's ugly.
He's in exile. You know,
he's in exile, right?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, I was just thinking of something while we were forth and backing here is I'm pretty sure that I cottoned to Epictetus at first more readily than Marcus or Seneca or Musonius Rufus, you know, the whole pantheon, because he was a marginalized figure, because he had demonstrated, you know, kind of incontrovertible adversity. And, you know, especially as a female, that I relate to that a lot, you know, just that sense of, you know, the you feel impelled to live a life of wisdom, but you're trying to do that within a world that's still doesn't quite take you seriously or doesn't give you the benefit of the doubt as being a sort of fully endowed human being, because, you know, the whole idea of man and men is kind of interchangeable.
Sure.
with man and men specifically. And so just, I mean, I am not saying I'm so oppressed, or that would be ridiculous. I mean, if you saw where I lived right now, if we were looking at each other, you'd say, shut up. It seemed like he earned his stoicism, but so did the others.
Sure,
so did in their the own others way. In their own way, on their own merits. Yeah.
Well, I think it's fascinating. Epictetus has this sort of working class vibe to him because, I mean, some of my favorite parts of Epictetus are, you know, he's working for Nero's secretary. So he's in the palace watching these insufferable, privileged, rich people bemoan the most preposterous things, right? You know, yeah. I think he says someone walks into Nero's court or his boss's court or something, and he says, you know, I'm down to my last $1 million. And he says, how have you survived? You know, like, or there's another scene where he talks about, you know, somebody, he watches someone suck up to Nero's cobbler. Right. Like he's so desperate to ingratiate himself into the inner workings of the palace. You know, he's sucking up to the guy that fixes Nero's shoes. And so there is this, I think the reason Epictetus is so much more relatable, and perhaps this is why he's not popular in the Ivy League, is that he knew those people and he hated them, and he talks about them with scorn and disgust because he, you know, he saw them up close and he knew there was nothing special about them.
Yes. Yes.
He even looks down on the fancy philosophers. You translate it pretty well in your book as well. But I love where one of his students is bragging about reading Chrysippus, who is you know, supposedly very obscure and difficult to understand. And Epictetus says, you know, if Chrysippus was a better writer, you wouldn't have anything to brag about.
Oh, man.
So he just hated those phony stuff shirts, you know, like he didn't. And yeah, he wasn't part of the old boys club. He wasn't part of the club at all. They made him go away to Nicopolis, but I mean, he wasn't a part of that. And I think it you feel that even 2,000 years later.
You do. You really do. And it seems like out of that exile, which is another way of saying, you know, he got to take a really good spiritual retreat there. it seems like what he bequeathed to us is a kind of vernacular language for talking about values. Because, well, Ryan, this is kind of a half-baked thought. Maybe you can find something here. I'm not sure
most,
if you can.
Most of mine are too, so don't worry about it.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm among friends. But, you know, if you've ever talked about values with other people or taken a class when the idea of values clarification or something like that, or even in the corporate world, it's the language of values to me is very wooden and abstract. And yet our values are the very thing that kind of animate our life, that, you know, that we actually do feel some passion about. And the simplicity of Epictetus's style of, I don't want to say writing exactly, because I know it comes, his words came through Arian, but there was just a kind of lack of pretension, and and it seemed like he had read Strunk and White. I mean, it was kind of incredible. Just there's no dead wood in his teachings. And because of that, I think when I say that he gave us a language to talk about values, I mean that less in terms of having a conversation with the next person. Oh, what are your values? X, Y, Z. What are yours? P, Q, R. But just with yourself, you get to clarify when you read him what matters and what doesn't. In the realm of thoughts and in the realm of words and deeds. And it's not that complicated.
No, I think that's right. I would imagine that it's because, so you take even Epictetus's teacher, Musonius Rufus, who does experience adversity, he's exiled, but, or you take a Seneca or whatever. These are brilliant ideas that they arrive to, it feels like, through thinking. Right?
Yes.
Through their study of the Stoics. It feels like Epictetus's are rooted on the bedrock of these experiences that, like, he's not sitting down and going, what is freedom? You know, and having some interesting dialogue about it. He's thinking about what does it mean to be free when I'm chained to a wall? Or what does it mean to be free when my leg has been broken by someone who owns me and my name literally means enslaved person? So I think it's like, it's almost as if he's coming at it from the opposite direction. So it's much closer rooted to real life than the other one. Like Seneca feels like he talked about all these things and then his life came to challenge him to actually live up to the words, and he does towards the end. But it feels like Epictetus is the reverse. He has the experiences and then spends the second half of his life talking about them, which is probably why I think Marcus Aurelius's writings are so brilliant, is that it's also right down against the nub of the experience. It's just a more privileged, sort of higher elite level set of experiences about leadership and stress and fame and power.
Yes, yes, and yes, and italicize that. I think it's maybe in some ways I'm just restating what you're saying, but I think that Marcus and Epictetus gain their authority as teachers because we all know what or we have some sense of what they actually went through. And experience is what gives wisdom, not fancy, abstract, philosophical pirouettes.
Do you think, speaking of Musonius Rufus, so I think this also goes to your point about how stripped down Epictetus is. You know, his teacher, Musonius, is referred to as the Roman Socrates, kind of known for his eloquence. It's fascinating to me that Epictetus would then sort of go so starkly in the other direction. But you mentioned this idea of sort of Epictetus being approachable or more accessible to women. Do you feel like, I know Musonius writes about teaching women and that virtue is genderless and that, you know, all of that. I guess we don't know, but I mean, where do you, having sort of immersed yourself in Epictetus's world, do you think he taught women? Do you think part of what the universality you're sensing, and do you think it's actually rooted in that's how he acted?
I couldn't conclusively say because I'm not a historian or a classicist, but I don't think so. I think that Epictetus's words were indeed a product of his experience, but to be a product of your experience doesn't mean that quite literally the only things you know are the things you experience, because when you experience something, it then imprints on your heart and mind. Well, kind of in a multivalent way. It's like when you have an experience, in a way, you also have access to the various potential analogies to that experience. I think that's what I'm grasping at. And so the guy was definitely a product of his time, and especially because across all of the extant literature from the ancient Stoics, doesn't talk too much about cooking or cleaning the house or taking care of the babies. And because of that, I think the women and girls were off doing that stuff. Sure. because you know, the men don't draw on that. Those, domesticity as a source of universal human wisdom, from that era.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Yeah, I just wonder if part of it's sort of like there is something remarkable about Musonius Rufus, who's teaching men and women and slaves. That must have been a pretty transgressive or at least progressive classroom that Epictetus comes to study philosophy in, at least compared to its time.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you know anything about? I don't know that much about Musonius Rufus besides a few fun facts and that he was Epictetus's teacher. But do you know how Musonius Rufus was received in the world? I mean, he had that moniker, the Roman Socrates, yeah. But I mean, how was he thought of?
I mean, he's exiled four times, so he's sort of a player, but then also kind of a constant thorn in the side of the powers that be. But he does have this fascinating lecture, which people can look at, called "Should Daughters Receive the Same Training as Sons?" And it's one of the few, you know, only like 10 or 15 of his writings survive. And this is one of them. So who knows how representative it is of the larger, you know, sort of bead. But it is striking to read this guy writing 2,000 years ago going like, he basically says, he's like, you don't care what gender your dog is or your horse. Like you know what they're capable of, and you feed and treat and train them accordingly. Why should you assume that your daughter is not capable of virtue or wisdom, or, you know, he's like, isn't temperance as important in a woman as courage is important to a man, or, you know, whatever. Obviously, there's pretty stratified gender roles in Rome at this time, but it is a remarkably progressive piece of writing when you think about what was happening at that time.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like he had to watch his backside a lot.
This might have been why he was exiled so many times.
Right. I think his fellow men probably...
They're like, dude, what are you doing?
Impatient with him.
So you mentioned that you're not a classicist. How... I know I get asked this question. So how the hell do you end up writing this translation of Epictetus that you know, brings him to, you know, thousands and thousands of people? It can't just be that he was neglected. It's a brave thing to do.
Yeah, or well, I don't know how brave it was or not, but all I can say is that I've always faced life as an autodidact, and when something intrigues me in any domain of experience, I hope I don't sound like a Northern California flake, but it's like life is saying beep beep. Beep beep, you know, it beeps at me, and I think you understand that as a kind of self-created person.
Sure.
And so I've always just kind of followed, and then fully dropped into the next good idea that comes. And so Epictetus. I can't account for the success of the Art of Living, and I'm not being falsely modest. It still kind of baffles me. It delights me too, of course. But I think a lot of times people are afraid to take on the mantle of knowing something or having the right to fully engage with something if they don't have certain societally conferred credentials. And it's so unfortunate. I guess in other words, I'm saying hip hip hooray for the popularizer, hip hip hooray for the amateur, but mostly hip hip hooray for living wide, but more importantly, living deep. And I hope I'm not starting to sound sententious, but
I think that's well said. It's like these ideas, these philosophers, they don't belong to anyone. They belong to everyone. And
exactly, Ryan. Yes,
I think there's something Seneca says. He goes like, if you really want to own the quotes or the ideas, you have to put them into practice, right? You have to engage with them in some way. And I think, I think it's two parts. So one, it's like these philosophers were not being particularly well served by the so-called academy. They were being forgotten or relegated or being unduly ignored. So the idea that it was sort of available is part one, but part two, the idea that you don't have to be a genius to interact with these people and add, put your own spin on them. In fact,
oopsie, that's what are you still there, for. Ryan?
Oh, okay. Yes. Sorry, can you hear me?
I can now, but I missed probably the last sentence and a half. Oh. So rewind the tape for me.
Yeah. No, I was just saying that like you don't have to be a genius to interact with these people. I mean, that's what's genius about the philosophy is that it's simple and straightforward. And we should be able to add our own experiences and connections to them. And that's how the philosophy continues to live on.
Yes.
But talk to me about popularizing, because I know I get that where people go, oh, you're just popularizing. And I go, thank you. That's an enormous compliment. but I imagine you've gotten a little bit of that criticism as well.
Oh, yeah. And first of all, I always, when I get that kind of pushback or even just aggressive meanness, I just always think, well, you don't want good ideas to just belong to an elite. Everyone should have access to good ideas, philosophical and otherwise. You know, it's sort of like saying, you know, only certain cooks get to read certain cookbooks or something. And I always believe, or at least it's my hope, my aspiration, that when people read something that is accessible, and but more to the point, that it actually its ideas, when applied in a reader's life, when those ideas are transformative in action, then I like to think that's an invitation to go to the primary sources. And if people have a problem with that, well, I don't have control over that.
That's what I was thinking when they were saying like, oh, you know, this is a pop, you know, these Silicon Valley programmers are reading a philosophy popular with Greek slaves. And I'm like, you're welcome. What else would you have them read? Like, tell me, like, I can think of so many things worse than popularizing an ancient philosophy that is based around virtue, meaning courage, right, exactly, justice, temperance, and wisdom. Like, what else? Like, tell me what you'd rather I be popularizing.
Yes. I often think, you know, the bitterness of critics is that they didn't do it, you know.
So walk me through your methodology, because you're not a classicist. So were you riffing on English translations? Were you actually reading it in the Greek and Latin? How, for people who are thinking about reading Epictetus, what is the, is it the provenance? What is the provenance of the words that show up in The Art of Living?
Well, what I did, and this is what I do when I think or write about anything, is I have a room in my house that has nothing in it, literally nothing, except for one pillow that I use to prop. I sit on the floor and I prop myself against the pillow on the wall. And then when I'm studying something with the intent to write, I make a circle of books around me, you know, books that are relevant to what I'm doing. And so in the case of Epictetus, I do read some Latin, though that wouldn't have been too helpful with Epictetus. But I gathered every English translation of the discourses that I love how they're called the diatribes. I always kind of get a little giggle out of that. But I surrounded myself with every translation I could get my hands on. I went to a lot of used bookstores in Berkeley to find them. But mostly I relied, ultimately after reading any number of these, my main companion was the George Long translation.
And so you're just sort of loosely riffing on how they translated it, trying to get sort of an accessible essence of what Epictetus was trying to say.
Well, I actually, so I decided that I would just, at least the first part of the book, I literally would read a passage of the Enchiridion. I based it on the Enchiridion. Mm-hmm. And so I followed the sequence of ideas in the Enchiridion and just, you know, I would read a page and then I would write it as, you know, as a modern woman trying to be intelligible to other people. And I guess that's, I mean, in some ways I'm having to, in my mind, reverse engineer this because I've sort of never had a method for anything except going into my spare room, which is kind of like this, you know, the metaphor of the blank canvas and possibility. Sure. And so forth. And just ideas occur in there. But I did strictly follow the progression of ideas in the Enchiridion. And then there's a part two of the book that is more kind of a cherry-picked synthesis of what I considered to be the key ideas across all of the discourses, the diatribes.
The sort of the essential teachings section.
Exactly.
So I have a question, and I hope this doesn't come off as an insult. I mean it as a compliment. How come no books since? No other translations, no other works on the Stoics. I'm just curious.
Well, the next big idea, not big idea, but good idea came along. And in a way, it was a natural outgrowth of Stoicism. And what it was is, it was music. I decided that I had a duty, you know, qua Stoicism, to liberate and make available the sound of this one-of-a-kind instrument that I had made for me when I was much younger, but hadn't. So I'm talking about this in the aftermath of the success of The Art of Living. I just thought to myself, well, what would be a different vessel for beauty and somehow communicating, I don't know, the value of goodness, virtue. Again, I'll just borrow that word. And I know that no one else is going to let the world have this sound. I mean, there's similar sounds to it, but I feel in some sense chosen to make this music and to write music for people. So that's pretty much what I threw myself into. I did take a stab in my agent at the time, right after Art of Living came out, and well, after it kind of exploded, you know, she said, "Oh man, this is your time. You've got to write, you know, Son of the Art of Living, or, you know, et cetera." And I tried doing it, and just that horse wouldn't go. I just wasn't interested. Interesting. I might be now. I'm actually working on a book about women in Stoicism right now. So it's not that I've given up writing. I mean, I still write small pieces.
Tell us about that, because I am fascinated. I think I was just talking about that to someone the other day. There is kind of this assumption, especially from Stoic critics, that the philosophy is just popular with dudes. And I know for a fact, because I hear from, it's like, it's not even close to that. It might even be tipping towards more popular with women than men. I've been fascinated with just how many women I hear from as far as the audience goes. What is your conceit with the book?
Well, I would say that I see the female posture in relation to Stoicism and philosophy, Western philosophy more generally, as in some ways we get to take on the role of Socrates vis-a-vis the tradition, because we've only recently become members of the conversation, and because of that we have that outsider perspective, that kind of gadfly way of viewing this tradition. And so in that way, I think we can clearly see, as this thing is developing, this thing known as modern Stoicism, we can appreciate its merits and its serviceable parts, but we can also see the conspicuous absences, the necessary things that are missing from modern Stoicism. And so my main thing is that I find the traditional Stoic virtues, you know, the four categories of temperance and oh God, I'm having an old lady moment here for a second. Help me out there. Pop quiz, the four virtues.
Courage, temperance, justice, wisdom.
Courage, temperance, justice, wisdom. Yeah, I think those are terrific virtues. And I think the entailments of those virtues are fabulous. But I call those virtues I virtues.
Okay.
Because they are ways of developing the virtue of an individual. And of course, that's where all change starts, right? All but sure. All good change starts, you know, I can't try and change you. I can only change me. However, what I see missing and what I think is fairly self-evident to women, whether they articulate it or not, is that we need we virtues too.
You don't think justice is a we virtue? I'm curious.
I think it can be spun as such, but I think, let's see, I'm thinking out loud right now, so I may speak kind of sloppy, but what I think is the I virtues, what I'm calling the I virtues, so just run with me here, mm-hmm. are... they are not rooted in the experience of human vulnerability and dependence, which are conditions that exist for all people, but are especially salient for females. Like when we're nursing our babies, we look down at a completely dependent, vulnerable person. And more than one eminence has said that the mother-child relationship is arguably the archetype for moral relationships. So what are these we virtues I'm talking about? I think they are the virtues that sustain and ignite the I virtues. So I came up with four we virtues, and I'm kind of curious what you think. This is all a work in progress. Okay, so the first one is nurturance, namely the active provision of emotional and physical care and protection for others. The second one, for the time being, I'm calling liberality, which is the willingness to respect or accept behavior or opinions different from your own, being open to new ideas like empathy, the ability to seek to understand and share the feelings of others. The third virtue, what am I calling? Oh, yeah, kindness. You know, simply the quality of being friendly, generous, and considerate. And finally, altruism, the selfless concern for the well-being of others. So I'm not saying that these four virtues can't be kind of juiced out of the official virtues, but why I think the we virtues are important, and not just important, but necessary, is because where we live, where we actually live, is not in ourselves, but in relationship.
Of course.
We live it, right. And because we live in relationship, I think we need virtues that affirm that and develop that locus. And so, for example, I think you could go off, you know, with your long father time beard and live in a cave or something, and you could by yourself develop courage. You could, maybe not justice. Yeah, you're definitely tripping me with justice. That's important. But the other three virtues, you could work on yourself every day in your cave, but you wouldn't necessarily then be able to, I think, live a fully morally expressed life once you came out of the cave and got a haircut, you know?
No, I get it. So I'm in the middle of, and I've talked about this on the podcast, but I'm in the middle of doing a 4-book series, one on each of the four virtues. So next month, I guess it'll be September 28th, the first one comes out, which is Courage is Calling. And I thought a lot about it because courage is this virtue that I think a lot of people can get wrong, in that it's just about braving risk or danger. I think to get to your point, and this is, so basically the way my book works is that the first part is about overcoming fear. The second part is about acting with courage. The third part of the book is exactly along the lines you're talking about, which is how do you get to away from the I part of the virtue and towards the we part of the virtue. So for me, the third part of the book is like the distinction between courage and heroism is that heroism is when it's about somebody else as opposed to you. So, you know, I was talking to a guy who was an instructor at the Naval Academy and he was talking about, he's like, jumping on a grenade is not heroic. It's only if you're jumping on a grenade to save someone else, right? Like if you can get away from the grenade and know it will hurt nobody else, then it's not courageous, right? It's stupid.
Right.
You know, so I think this idea of the we virtues is really important because, you know, Stoicism is so much an individual philosophy and it's what is guiding, you know, Epictetus through this horrendous adversity, but it would be worthless if he hadn't become a teacher or a, you know, if he hadn't helped all these people throughout the centuries. I think James Stockdale being a great example of taking Epictetus's virtues and making them we virtues in that prison camp where he was protecting and supporting and fighting for the people next to him. So I love the concept of I versus we virtues. I think it's really important.
Thank you.
I can't wait to read the book. It sounds amazing.
Well, likewise, I'm sure. I think that's wonderful, just homing in on each of those virtues. I really look forward to just talking to you outside of these
let's keep going. It's amazing. I loved The Art of Living. It helped put me on the path that I'm on today, so thank you for that, and I look forward to the new book.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Thanks for being you.
Likewise. All right, here, let me hit stop.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.